Support for WPR comes from Tomorrow River Community Virtual School, delivering Waldorf-inspired live virtual lessons to grades 4K through 8th, open to all Wisconsin students. More is at trcvs.org.
Support for WPR comes from Doulaying the Doula, offering birth and postpartum training and certification programs for medical professionals and other interested humans. More information about training is at doulaworkshop.com.
Girls that aren't cut out for business careers usually wind up married to some nice man. That's what you'll do.
But Mother...
Yes?
I'm crippled.
Nonsense. Laura, I've told you never, never to use that word. Well, you're not crippled. You just have a little defect. Hardly noticeable, even. When people have some slight disadvantage like that, they cultivate other things to make up for it. Develop charm and vivacity. And charm, that's all you have to do. That's a scene from Tennessee Williams' The Glass Menagerie, one of many examples of the portrayal of disability in literature. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Laura Wingfield, Tiny Tim, Richard III, Captain Hook, just a few of the characters that might come to mind if we think of literary characters with disabilities, but there are many more. How have authors used disability to shed light on society's treatment of those with any kind of difference? What attitudes toward the disabled in real life are revealed in an exploration of disabled characters in fiction? Joining us to discuss literature and disability is Ellen Samuels. She's a professor of gender and women's studies and English at the UW-Madison and also part of the UW's Disability Studies Cluster.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
The mind runs rampant pretty quickly. I mean, you think right away, anybody from Captain Ahab to, stretching a point, Darth Vader. If we look at characters whose disability are part of the storyline, do we see patterns?
Well, yes. What's interesting is that all of these are representations of disability. So the authors made a choice about how to represent their disability and what function it's going to serve in the narrative. So there are three stereotypes of disability representation we often talk about. The heroic overcomer, that's like the paraplegic who climbs Mount Everest, or the blind student who earns a PhD. And when we hear those stories, the reactions we're supposed to have involve feeling inspired, feeling impressed, thinking, wow, if they can do it, what am I complaining about? Mm-hmm. They're so plucky, they're so spunky, they're so precious. The second representational stereotype of disability that's really prevalent is the tragic victim. So anything from Tiny Tim in Dickens to media stories about children, as they would put it, afflicted, suffering from disabilities. And the tragic victim, of course, we feel pity. We feel that their situation is so terrible that they often would be better off dead than suffering the way they are. And in fact, in literature and film, those characters often die and sometimes seem to die from no more than an excess of being pitiable rather than some specific etiology.
Sounds very 19th century.
Right. Yes. Uncle Tom's Cabin features a lot of characters like that. And then the third stereotype we see, and this is really prevalent in literature and film, is the vengeful villain. Like you mentioned Darth Vader, and Emily mentioned Captain Hook, and of course Richard III and Shakespeare. These characters who are either because they were born disabled or because they became disabled, often by losing a limb, become consumed with vengeance against the world. They become incredibly villainous, and there's this tremendous satisfaction then that the reader or the viewer feels at their downfall at the end.
And it sometimes seems it's part of the way the author portrays a kind of monstrosity. I'm thinking with Richard III, even in the language he'll use about himself, he almost calls himself a monster as if he's not quite whole, not quite
well. Right. That's what the dogs seem to think.
Yes. Yes, exactly. The dogs bark at him as he goes by. And it's interesting because if you go back to the roots of the word monster, right, it's related to demonstrate, to show. So it becomes this question of how do monstrous bodies get read culturally? What are they thought of as showing us? And in these representations, it often seems that they show us essentially that it's better to be dead than disabled, unless you can either become a villain and try to conquer the world. But then, of course, from our moral stance, we don't want them to succeed. We want them to. And those ventral villains almost inevitably die at the end of whatever narrative they're featured in. And or we think, oh, how inspiring that they've overcome this disability and they become this kind of object rather than a person who's just living their life in an everyday way. And what's interesting is that the heroic overcomer is the dominant narrative that we see in mass media these days, just everywhere you look.
Yes.
There's a billboard put up by a group called the Foundation for a Better Life. You've probably seen these billboards. They have a picture of some real-life person and a word that's one of the values. So this is a picture of a runner with a prosthetic leg.
Right.
And it says,
sure.
Overcoming, pass it on. And
like Terry Fox, I mean, classic
right,
example.
Right, exactly. And one of the hardest things for me in teaching classes in disability studies is to get my students to look beyond celebrating those overcoming stories and see the ways in which they ignore two things. One is that the barriers that these people have overcome are often social, not physical. And I'll say more about that in a second. The other thing is that they're seen as just individuals who've overcome through their will, their spirit, their spunk, their determination, when in fact, they've usually relied on other people, on a social system, and on the civil rights that have been won for disabled people in this country, especially with the passage of the ADA in 1990. So if you look at, say, the quadriplegic student who graduated from Harvard, she's also featured on one of those Foundation for a Better Life billboards. She was able to attend Harvard because her mother came and spent 4 years living with her, going to her classes with her, helping her do physical things like read and write. Now, under the ADA and under the kinds of social programs that people with disabilities tend to advocate, everyone would have the right to that kind of assistance, whether they had a mother who had the willingness and the ability to give up 4 years or not. So that person didn't just overcome through her determination. She overcame through this unusual family support. Now, why shouldn't anyone with any disability who wants to attend college have the access to that kind of support?
Well, there's an interesting split there, it seems to me, and you find it in one particular real person who does turn up in various forms of literature. And the split is between those who attempt to conceal the disability and those who do not. And I'm thinking of Franklin D. Roosevelt, mm-hmm. who, of course, is in the musical Annie. He's also depicted in films. In the film 1941, I think it is, or a similar one, there's a dramatic moment when the president, who was always seated, stands to mm-hmm. make a point, you know, that we will prevail. In Annie, I think he's always in the wheelchair. And there was a real controversy some years ago about a statue of FDR
right.
where he was in the wheelchair. And it really
right.
split people, including, I think, those with the same disability.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Roosevelt's a fascinating case. And there's a book, I don't recall the author, called FDR's Splendid Deception, all about the ways in which during his presidency he, although he was known to be a polio survivor, he was known to sometimes use a wheelchair, he would often rely on Secret Service and other people to support him so that he would appear standing or
and
appear
to be walking.
And
the press cooperated with that.
And the press cooperated, whereas today you could imagine the press,
right.
you know, snapping pictures with camera phones and them going viral. Oh, look, the president this, the president that. In terms of the statue, that was an interesting point. You know, the Roosevelt Memorial shows him sitting but doesn't show his wheelchair. And especially by the time we were in World War II, like the time that Roosevelt is perhaps most kind of celebrated, he was using his wheelchair pretty much full time. So a lot of historians and disability activists were upset that his wheelchair was not portrayed because they felt like it made it invisible. Here was someone who could be this tremendous role model of possibilities for people who are wheelchair users, and it was made invisible. So they added this small memorial of him in his wheelchair, and they convened a group of historians and people who write about disability representation to come up with a quotation to illustrate the statue. And the committee chose a quotation by Roosevelt, and of course I don't remember it verbatim, but it was essentially talking about fighting for the rights of all people. The government body making the statue did not use that quotation. They used one from Eleanor Roosevelt talking about how Franklin always wanted to do things without getting help from anybody. So again, you see how...
Well, I guess that's choosing to go with the heroic overcomer
idea.
And actually, you know, coming back to the point of the heroic overcomer, do you think there's a danger? Do you think there's a problem with the heroic overcomer label in the sense that if you think of Helen Keller, where she can be blind and deaf yet accomplish great things, does it put inordinate pressure on people with disability that somehow if they don't get that PhD from Harvard, if they can't do it, that there's something wrong with them? Sort of like the equivalent, I suppose, of the pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. It puts pressure on those who can't make it.
Right. It puts a pressure, and it particularly puts a pressure that you're supposed to do these things all by yourself, and that if you don't, it's because of a failure of will on your part rather than a failure of the larger society to do things as simple as put in ramps or provide alternative formats. If you read the narratives of people with significant physical disabilities who went to college before the ADA in 1990, they're just filled with stories of needing to do things like ask passerbys to carry them upstairs to get to class every day, of not going to the bathroom all day and not drinking anything because there were no accessible bathrooms. And those are besides the stories of just being blatantly told, you can't come to college here because you're disabled, right? Because there were no protections against saying things like that. So the fact that now so many more people with various kinds of disabilities can do things like attend college and gain employment is not because people became more determined or there was a reduction in the number of actual disabled people being challenged by their physical state. It was because of civil rights changes and changes in the physical environment. And that is what in disability studies we refer to as the social model of disability, the idea that disability is not an individual tragedy or defect. It's an interaction between any individual with some level of ability or disability and their social environment and their built environment. So if, for example, everyone spoke sign language, then deaf people would not really be disabled in most circumstances. Even the simple fact that now we have text messaging and the internet has made a huge difference in the lives of deaf people who before were excluded by our reliance on telephones.
That's
similarly.
Yeah.
Right.
So it seems to be a fundamental difference between, I'm going to skip over the sort of the victim category right now and look at the other two, the super achiever and the villain. The difference between them and the victim is that they are more active as opposed to passive, maybe.
Absolutely.
And one, if I'm reading you right, is this overachiever who can accomplish these great things but in a social context.
Right.
However, the villain, are they more likely to go it alone?
Yes. I mean, they have cronies. They have followers. Every good villain has their henchmen, right? Their crew on the pirate ship.
Right.
Their stormtroopers.
I'm thinking of Ahab, though. I mean,
Ahab had the whole crew of the Pequod.
That's one way of looking at it.
Helping him,
yeah.
And he brought them all to their doom, except Ishmael, right?
Uh-huh.
But here's what I see as the biggest difference between the two. The heroic overcomer, very common in the mass media, not that common in literary representations. The vengeful villain, really common in literary and now film representations, virtually no actual real-life examples. You just don't hear about disabled people who, you know, were filled with vengeance against the world and became villains in some way. You can't make some argument that the great villains of history, like Hitler, in any way driven by some kind of disability. And certainly with the argument that you see or the representation that you see in someone like Captain Ahab, the whale took his leg, Captain Hook, the whale, I mean, the crocodile took his hand. If that were true, and now, particularly with the wars we're in now, we have many more veterans coming back with kinds of amputations, we'd have these kind of gangs of supervillains roaming the street. And so you really, in that case, you really have to start asking, what narrative function do these characters serve? What symbolic function do they serve? Because they're not drawing from real life examples.
Well, let's take Shakespeare's Richard III.
Okay.
An early example of a villain, in this case not with a missing limb, but with a misshapen form. Can you say something about Shakespeare's characterization of him?
Absolutely. Well, you know, Richard III is considered one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays to be performed. It's considered one of the best roles for an actor to perform. Many actors from the Royal Shakespearean have taken on Richard III over the years, maybe most famously Ian McKellen in the 1995 film. And one of the reasons for this is that he's such a complex character. His villainy changes throughout the play. But what doesn't change is his self-representation, as well as other characters' representation of him as being villainous because he was born with this disability that's variously described as a hunchback, a withered arm, limping, halting, and different actors and directors have interpreted how to perform that disability differently. There's a lot of historical evidence. There's still some controversy over it, but most people think that the real Richard III, the Duke of Gloucester in the Wars of the Roses, was not necessarily disabled, but it was after his defeat that his monstrosity, his villainy, the fact that he killed so many people, including family members, including, you know, children who were in his way between him and the throne, that monstrosity then got written up in the history as disability, and that's the source that Shakespeare used for his portrayal.
I think Madame Tussaud actually represents him without the hunchback.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, I remember right.
If you take the Ian McKellen version of it, maybe we could listen to the opening, the famous, you know, Winter of Our Discontent speech from the play, and then talk about the significance of the language.
This is the very beginning of the play. The family of York is celebrating their defeat of the House of Lancaster and taking the throne of England. Richard comes in and begins his famous soliloquy, which begins, "Now is the winter of our discontent." He's celebrating the victory, supposedly, of his brother. But then he turns, and in the Ian McKellen version, he actually leaves the room with the crowd and starts talking to the mirror in the men's room. And he says,
"But I that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking glass, I that am rudely stamped, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world, scarce half made up. And that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. In this weak, piping time of peace, I've no delight to pass away the time. Unless to espy my shadow and the sun and descant on mine own deformity. I can smile and murder while I smile, and wet my cheeks with artificial tears, and frame my face to all occasions. And therefore, since I cannot prove a lover, I'm determined to prove a villain, and hate the idle pleasures of these days."
Well, the psychology there at the end seems to be valid. There are stories about people, I mean, real people who sort of, if they can't win one way, they're willing to, geez, just be as perfectly bad as they can. I mean, you see them in court, you know, in criminal cases where they do their utmost just to be the villain.
Right. I think there's certainly people, disabled and non-disabled alike, who would take on villainy. I think it's a little more of a stretch to suggest, as Richard does, and as Shakespeare does in the soliloquy, that the fact that he cannot prove a lover, as he puts it inevitably turns him toward villainy. And it's also, as many critics have pointed out, ironic in that very soon after that, there's a scene where he very successfully woos Lady Anne, literally over the corpse of her dead husband that he's killed.
Well, she must be a piece of work, too, let's face it.
Yeah, I mean, there's many different ways to interpret Lady Anne, but certainly it seems that Richard is able to prove a lover on some level or another, so his argument isn't really consistent.
Well, you know, that may be true for Richard, but that does bring to mind another case that we haven't mentioned yet, who does not succeed at love for a slightly different reason. That's Frankenstein's monster.
Oh, Frankenstein's monster.
Now, his disability, you could argue, is simply his looks, as he seems to be perfectly fit otherwise.
Right.
But because people reject him, and he tells us this in endless pages of monologue,
yes.
Because people reject him because of his appearance, he decides to go bad. Now, at one point, he tries to get a wife, of course, and Frankenstein, Dr.
Right.
Frankenstein, destroys that project before completing it, and then the monster really goes on a tear.
Right.
That's more like what Richard's talking about.
I think to turn the conversation a little bit, Frankenstein, Richard III, Captain Ahab, all these characters are literary characters created at a historical moment out of a certain metaphorical language that's available to the authors creating them, right? In no case, I mean, Shakespeare is basing his character off a history, which, you know, then many have suggested is an altered history. You certainly know that Mary Shelley did not say, oh, I'm basing this on this guy down the street that pieced together some pieces of corpses. And instead, you can think about, for example, the shift that happens between this idea of the monster in what we'd call the early modern or medieval periods as a figure of wonder, right? The monster is someone who shows us the wonder of the world, the vagaries of creation. As Richard says, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time. So that either nature or God or some merging of those has sent us these different kinds of bodies to tell us something. Now, with the Enlightenment and the Age of Science in the 18th century, by the 19th century, when Shelley writes Frankenstein or Melville writes Moby Dick, there's much more of a sense that science has something to do.
Right. Yes.
With mm-hmm. monstrous bodies.
And so that then we you could create have, monsters.
Right. So then you could have Richard saying, cheated a feature by that doctor mm-hmm. who botched the delivery. Let's sue
Enter
him.
Enter malpractice suit. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so what's interesting for me about the study of disability in literature then is to move from what these individual characters sort of tell us about humanity and think, what do they tell us about this historical moment, about the way attitudes toward disability were changing, and what disability was taken to mean? And there's many examples in the 19th century in both British and American literature, and I think that is because the 19th century was a time of such tremendous shifts in our understandings of bodies, the relationship of bodies to society, to ideas about perfection or imperfection, to nature, to science.
So how does guilt or culpability or blame figure into that shift in thinking? In other words, Richard is mm-hmm. saying, who's to blame for this? Frankenstein's monster is saying, who's to blame for this?
Right. Well, I'm going to talk about, to answer that, I'm going to talk about a novel that few are familiar with, also by Herman Melville, called The Confidence Man. It was his last mm-hmm. published novel. And I have an interesting anecdote about this. When I started my graduate program to get my PhD in English at the University of California, Berkeley, I had already been doing some work on disability and literature, but I was determined not to look at every text through just this one lens. And I took a class from a very noted Melville scholar, and I said, I'm just going to go in and learn from him and not bring my own agenda. And I'd never read The Confidence Man. I'd read Moby Dick. And I started reading it, and the first chapter and the first line of the book is, a mute goes aboard a ship in Mississippi. And I thought, okay. And then the mute character goes on this boat, and who does he encounter but a legless African-American man who's cavorting for the passengers, and they're throwing coins at him, and he's catching them in his mouth. And I said, okay, this seems to be happening. And this whole novel is simply the story of all these different passengers on this ship, and they're encountering this wily confidence man who takes on these different guises. There's no real plot to it. It was not a well-received or successful novel, partly for that reason. But throughout it, there's many, many characters who have some kind of physical disability. The invalid, the man with one leg, et cetera, et cetera. So I came into my class and I raised my hand and I said, has anyone said anything about disability in this book? And the professor, this very wonderful Melville scholar, said, no. Is there disability in this book? And that really highlights how if you take disability as a naturalized, incidental, individual occurrence, or always as a metaphor for something else, always as a metaphor for broader human right. failings, etc., then it becomes almost invisible, but it's really everywhere. And this professor then, in a, what for me was a really wonderful example of a scholar and a mentor, said, wow, it is everywhere. I'm going to edit a special journal issue on Melville and disability. Will you publish something in it, et cetera, et cetera? So it was an example of, you know, someone who just never thought about it before but was tremendously open to it. But the character, so that's all an introduction to that novel. There's a character in that who's called the Soldier of Fortune. Most of these characters don't really have names. His name is Thomas Fry, but he's mostly referred to as the Soldier of Fortune. He became crippled, as Melville puts it, because he was held as a material witness in a case in a prison where the conditions were so bad that his legs became withered and he had to walk with crutches. And so he's on this boat begging for alms. But he doesn't say that this is what happened to him. He says, I'm a vet of the Mexican-American War, and I was injured in this way. And so that gets him sympathy from the other passengers in a way that his real story wouldn't, because we can accept the narrative of the heroic soldier who's injured in battle. We can't accept a narrative of this complete injustice that happened to him, because that would disrupt American understandings of democracy and right and wrong at the time. So going back to this question of guilt, is he guilty of deception? Is he guilty of lying? Or is it justified? And this is not something Melville answers. Melville raises tricky questions like this to challenge his readers. You see exactly the same thing in the movie Ray, the biopic of Ray Charles that came out a few years ago with Jamie Foxx. Early in the movie, Ray, played by Jamie Foxx, is trying to get on a bus and go to the city and try to make his way in the world, and he's been blind since he was a young boy. And the bus driver, who's white, and they're in the South, and he's racist, says, you can't ride my bus. And Ray replies, I was wounded. He says something about how he lost his sight in the war. And the driver says, oh, I didn't realize that. Come on in, you know, I'll give you the best seat, etc. So you can see how that's not a change in what we call the impairment. That's a change in the symbolic value and the narrative attached to that impairment.
It is a fascinating phenomenon. We'll look further at disability in literature when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I've got a rope up here that even Jenny did not find. If that woman does get out and tries to get away, I can tie her. But I forgot I could not reach far without anything to stand on. This bed will not move. I tried to lift and push it until I was lame, and then I got so angry I bit off a little piece of one corner, but it hurt my teeth. Then I peeled off all the paper I could reach standing on the floor. It sticks horribly, and the pattern just enjoys it. All those strangled heads and bulbous eyes and waddling fungus growth just shriek with derision. I am getting angry enough to do something desperate. That's from Charlotte Perkins Gilman's The Yellow Wallpaper, and shows a woman going sort of mad. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Ellen Samuels, and we're talking about disability and literature. I want to ask you about even just the topic of disability and what counts, because we have physical disabilities. We've talked about Richard III, about Tiny Tim, Laura Wingfield in Glass Menagerie, and so on. There's also mental disabilities. There are people who are treated as if they're somehow different because of their race or gender. I mean, what counts if in the world of disability studies as even being disability?
Right. That's an excellent question. And relates to another question that I won't go into too much detail, which is, in real life, how do we define disability? The ADA has a definition, the Social Security has a definition, the World Health Organization has a definition, and they all serve different functions. And I only mention that to point out that even in daily life, in politics, in law, there are different definitions of disability that circulate. So although we often think of disability as a fairly obvious or natural or transparent category, it's always being defined and constructed in different historical moments for different purposes. Now, in literature, most of us bring together a range of what we would call non-normative bodies, non-normative minds, and that you can bring together these really different states of impairment, from paraplegia to being an amputee to being quote-unquote insane to having a cognitive disability like Benji and Faulkner's Sound and the Fury, and that what unites these characters, what enables us to analyze them, is two things. One is that they're represented as non-normative, as differing from the expected norms of their social and representational context. The other is they often seem to serve really similar functions within narrative. So you read the example from The Yellow Wallpaper. Now, that's a story by Charlotte Perkins Gilman from the 19th century that she wrote very much to both illustrate and protest certain attitudes toward some women of her time that she herself had experienced, that women who were unhappy, say, with their traditional female role as wife and mother, and were expressing that unhappiness through developing what today we might call depression or anxiety, but then was described as neurasthenia and hysteria, should be confined to their rooms, confined to their beds, not allowed to read, not allowed to write, not allowed to see people. This was called the rest cure. So she writes a story which essentially takes the narrator from sounding like a very normal woman who's just really bored and frustrated being shut up in her room to, by the end, this descent into insanity, as illustrated in the passage you read, where she seems completely out of her mind, thinking she's the woman in the wallpaper, chewing on the bedstead, ripping the wallpaper off the walls, wanting to tie people up so she can escape. And in that case, we can both see that by the end, she seems to fit what we might call this literary diagnostic category of mental illness or insanity, but also that that state has been reached through what appears to be outward means rather than some kind of inward flaw or defect. And it then raises questions about, to what extent can we ever fix disability? And there isn't really an answer. It's always a shifting category. That's part of why it is so powerful and prevalent and useful in representation, I think.
Do we get to a point in literature? I'm sure we do, but at what point would it be where we find disability as just an incidental description rather than something that really is that, I'll say, big a deal to the reader, if not to the character being involved? I mean, I can think of some instances in TV and film where the detective just happens to have, I mean, the actor just happens to have one arm, and no mention is ever made of it. Or in The Best Years of Our Lives, which was a 1946 film, a character literally had two hooks for hands. He was a real war veteran. No mention of it made, although it's sort of incorporated into, obviously, his physical actions in this film. But at what point do we get there?
Well, I'm not familiar with that film. It makes me want to see it. But once I see it, I'll be really interested to see to what extent his disability, his prosthetic hands, function symbolically, even if they're not referred to in the dialogue. And many people have theorized that disability often functions as what they call a kind of disruption in the text or in or visually in the film, and even in interactions between disabled people and non-disabled people, that it's almost impossible not to have your eye drawn to signs of difference and to think about how they function. And if you don't draw attention to the disabilities, it's become like the elephant in the room. On the other hand, I think the spirit of your question is something like, how do we empty some of the negative attachments, symbolic attachments of disability, and normalize it such that it is part of what we might say the range of human difference,
exactly,
rather than this stigmatized difference. And I would say that that is the goal of much disability activism. In terms of disability representation, I think it's difficult because there's always going to be a weight of representation that you're writing back to and through, and you can't ever empty anything of its representation. I'm thinking, if you think about race, right, we're still at a point where you'll hear someone described as a black person, an Asian person, but you rarely hear them described as a white person, right, because white has been normalized as the default.
Exactly.
So similarly, being without disability has been normalized as the default. Every time you name disability, then you're always already naming a kind of difference. So I would say, what if we started referring to all non-disabled people as non-disabled or able-bodied or something like that? How would that refocus the idea of difference away from those seen as non-normative?
Well, it's interesting because we did a program some time ago with a deaf actor who was here for production, and he was talking about deaf culture and sometimes the celebration of a certain difference as well and not wanting it necessarily to be regarded as a lack. I was thinking, too, in the categories that you gave, you mentioned three, the heroic overcomer, the sort of pitiable victim, and then the vengeful
right,
villain. It seems to me there's this other thing that perhaps we could talk about, which is the idea of the person with a disability who is almost a visionary or who can perhaps see more. You know, an example was the woman in the yellow wallpaper who starts to see amazing things in that wallpaper. But then if you think of Vincent van Gogh or,
right,
you know, Frida
right,
Kahlo or whatever, that sometimes the painful disability or the difference leads to a kind of heightened sense.
Right. Yeah, I think there's many examples. Also, the idea of the blind seer,
yes,
right, is
yes,
extremely
oh, yes,
powerful, going all the way back to Greek classic literature. I think that that's, if it's possible to separate out the two things you said, I think the idea of disability, because it's part of the range of normal human difference. We've always had disability and we always will. There will never be an eradication of disability from the human condition. That it's possible in many ways to celebrate it and to see the diversity that it adds to everything from daily life to literature and film. On the other hand, there's often this kind of strange myth about the compensatory aspect of disability. So the most common version of this would be, if you lose one sense, the other ones become heightened. Now, that apparently isn't true. It isn't borne up by any actual research or facts. And so you start to think, why do those of us who haven't lost a sense want to tell ourselves that? Is it to comfort ourselves at the thought that if the unthinkable, horrible thing were to happen, and we often think this when we encounter someone who's different from us. Oh, what if I went blind? What if I became deaf? How would I survive? Well, fortunately, I would develop this preternatural ability to, you know, solve mysteries through my sense of smell. Or in the Marvel comic book superhero character Daredevil, right? He loses the accident that makes him lose his sight, gives him all these other reflexes and abilities such that he can become a superhero. And so then you have to think, what work is that myth doing? But to go back to what, of course, is kind of the more appealing idea of disability as a valuable difference and something that can enhance creativity and enhance literary and artistic production, I thought maybe this could be a good time to look at Cheryl Murray Wade's poem.
And there you're talking about an author with a disability herself.
Yes, an author with a disability, an author who is resisting being given what, you know, the attempt to empty disability of its stigma in a kind of superficial, static way by adopting euphemistic terms like differently abled, physically challenged.
And she definitely lays it on the line.
Right. And she's saying, you know, don't put me in some kind of benign, patronizing, euphemistic category. Look at the realities and the particularities of my disabled experience and how it's a source of power for me.
Well, let's hear the poem.
Okay. This is by Cheryl Murray Wade, I Am Not One of the. I am not one of the physically challenged. I'm a sock in the eye with a gnarled fist. I'm a French kiss with cleft tongue. I'm orthopedic shoes sewn on a last of your fears. I am not one of the differently abled. I'm an epitaph for a million imperfect babies left untreated. I'm an icon carved from bones in a mass grave in Tiergarten, Germany. I'm withered legs hidden with a blanket. I am not one of the able disabled. I'm a black panther with green eyes and scars like a picket fence. I'm pink lace panties teasing a stub of milk-white thigh. I'm the evil eye. I'm the first cell divided. I'm mud that talks. I'm Eve. I'm Kali. I'm the mountain that never moves. I've been forever. I'll be here forever. I'm the gimp. I'm the cripple. I'm the crazy lady. I'm the woman with juice.
She's doing what occasionally you see in poetry, and that is pointing out that there's this cool web of language that we use to, it's almost like a spider, you know, wrapping its victim and numbing it and making it go away, that if you get back to those other words that are less politically correct, they really put the point on the problem or the situation.
Absolutely. I think you put that very well. And some of the terms she uses, I'm the gimp, I'm the cripple, are terms that have been reclaimed by large parts of the disability community and authors with disabilities writing literature these days. You'll have performance groups called the GIMP Project or the GIMP Parade. You'll have a lot of people who refer to themselves as Crips. You have a movement now of hip-hop called Crip-Hop by African-American disabled artists. But you don't see large groups of disabled people getting together and saying, we're physically challenged. That's really, again, a label, as you put it, put on people to kind of make them go away.
It's a little bit patronizing in some ways.
Yes.
We're going to have some final thoughts about literature and disability when we continue in a moment with the University of the Year.
The creator and sovereign of this enormous house with the four sickle pear trees in the front yard and the single elm in the backyard was Eva Peace, who sat in a wagon on the third floor directing the lives of her children, friends, strays, and a constant stream of boarders. Fewer than 9 people in the town remembered when Eva had 2 legs, and her oldest child, Hannah, was not one of them. Unless Eva herself introduced the subject, no one ever spoke of her disability. They pretended to ignore it, unless, in some mood of fancy, she began some fearful story about it, generally to entertain children. How the leg got up by itself one day and walked on off. How she hobbled after it, but it ran too fast. Or how she had a corn on her toe, and it just grew and grew and grew until her whole foot was a corn. And then it traveled on up her leg and wouldn't stop growing until she put a red rag at the top. But by that time, it was already at her knee.
From the novel Sula by Toni Morrison. As read by our guest, Ellen Samuels. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air, and we're looking at disability in literature. And, well, there's none better than Toni Morrison. And she, with that characteristic wry understatement there, kind of cuts both ways in terms of, well, I have this disability, but everybody's going to ignore it. But, hey, I'll call attention to it myself, although it may be in a very whimsical way.
Right. I think that's exactly right, that the character of Eva Peace cuts both ways. She is a very powerful figure for a disabled figure in literature. She doesn't really fit one of the representational stereotypes. She's described as the creator and the sovereign of the world she lives in, rather than a one-legged African-American woman who sits in a wagon and doesn't leave her bedroom, right, which you could see described as a very marginal or disempowered position. And in this passage, Morrison goes on to talk about Eva's endless stream of gentlemen callers, how she's always beautifully put together and magnificent. She refuses to wear a slipper on her remaining foot, you know, so she refuses to take on this character of kind of the invalid. So people will point out Eva Peace as an example of a powerful disabled woman whose disability is both, and perhaps paradoxically, incidental and the source of her power on
and
some level.
It seems the source of her narrative creativity. She tells stories about it, using it as kind of a point of departure.
Absolutely. And in the novel, we learn that Eva was absolutely at the end of her rope with no money, no resources, and these very small children, and that she left the children with a neighbor and disappeared and came back a few months later with one leg, no one knowing what had happened. But for the rest of her life, she received checks that enabled her to support her children. And so it becomes, again, this paradox. Did she give up this part of herself to attain independence, power, autonomy, the ability to care for her family and her extended community? And do we celebrate that, or do we condemn it for the racism and the other factors that reduced her to that point of desperation? And I think it's both. I think that's what's so powerful, of course, about the way Toni Morrison writes, is that you can't impose simple moral judgments onto her characters or onto her novels.
There does seem to be a tradition, though, of the handicapped person sometimes becoming this object of myth, though. In this case, she's making her own myths, you know, by telling these stories. But again, that person who is different sometimes can become seen as someone special by the community.
Absolutely. And Eva Peace is, for most of the novel, a powerful figure, although by the end of the novel, like many, if not most, disabled characters in literature, she does kind of meet her doom. She throws herself out the window. But if we look at other mythologies of the 20th and into the 21st century, I mean, one that really comes to mind is this idea of the superhero, right? The superhero who you can say can be traced back to the heroes of Greek mythology, to Hercules and Perseus, etc., but who takes on this particular form in the 20th century of people, characters who encounter some kind of profound injury or accident that in real life would either kill them or leave them profoundly disabled in some way, but instead gives them superpowers, and some become villains and some become heroes. So you have Hulk exposed to the gamma radiation, and you have Spider-Man bitten originally by a radioactive spider and then in a, you know, 21st century update by a genetically altered spider. And what's interesting is these representations emerge and become really powerful in the 1940s, essentially, which is a time when industrial accidents in the increasingly industrialized United States have reached a real height, but there's not yet so many regulations to protect workers. So you have all kinds of terrible things happening to workers, losing limbs and chemical injuries. And then you have arising these powerful myths of people who fall into pools of acid and gain superpowers, or even have tremendous traumas happening to them, like Batman witnessing his parents killed in front of him and becoming a superhero.
What does that say about us, that we, it's our way of coping with the sort of the way you said that we like to perhaps, if we see a blind person, imagine, well, if we went blind, we'd have heightened other senses. Is the superpower process just our way of coping with the possibilities?
I think, again, it serves multiple functions. It might be a comforting myth to us, but of course we don't really believe that if those accidents or injuries happen to us, we'd gain superpowers. It comforts us on a symbolic level, but it also suggests to us the importance of and the power of human diversity. And I think you really see that in the mythology of the X-Men and this idea of mutation and the arguments put forward in both the comic book and the movies about, is this human evolution or is this the downfall of the human race. And I think that speaks to all kinds of anxieties today about the future of genetics and the human genome and globalization.
Well, the fear there, once you get so far beyond the handicap that in some way is a human situation, you get so far beyond that that you become superhuman, there's this anxiety about losing your humanity. Sometimes the superhuman has no humanity.
Right. Absolutely. And then you start to ask these questions. For example, if you have someone like the Bionic Man or the Bionic Woman or these other kind of cyborg figures, where does robot end and human begin?
Data in Star Trek,
the Cylons in Battlestar Galactica. I mean, science fiction is really a rich ground to look at different ways to imagine disability and human diversity and what the future of the human is going to be.
One of the films you sometimes show when you teach a class on literature and disability is Gattaca. Can you say why you include that one?
Well, Gattaca is very interesting because it's a future vision of a world in which disability is treated very, what you might say, retroactively. So it's this world in which all children are supposed to be genetically designed and free of any defects or flaws. And if you have your children the old-fashioned way, without genetically designing them, they're known as invalids, they're socially stigmatized, and it centers around this character of Vincent, who then becomes Jerome, who is an invalid, who decides, like the heroic overcomer, that he can overcome all of his genetic defects and reach a level of accomplishment, a social class that he's supposed to be genetically forbidden to reach. And he does so by taking on the identity of a genetically perfect man, played by Jude Law, the original Jerome, who's had an accident and become a paraplegic and uses a wheelchair. And so the movie tries to foreground that no matter how perfectly you try to plan the human race, in matter if you can genetically cure all possible diseases and defects, there always will be people with disabilities, and there always will be people who can do more than what was thought of them based on their physiology or their genetics.
That all comes out of, I think, you know, the experiments with eugenics, not just in Germany, but in this country too in the 30s, this concept that you could weed out those who were subpar physically.
Right, absolutely. And we condemn eugenics today because of its racialism, because of its ascribing of all kinds of negative traits to non-white races and to Jewish people. But if you hear someone today say, I had prenatal testing and I screened out Down syndrome, we think that's a good thing. And so what are the different valences that we're putting on different kinds of bodies, different kinds of minds, and when are we going too far when we try to eliminate different kinds of people through genetics? And I don't say that to condemn anyone personally making some kind of choice about prenatal testing, but a lot of people are raising questions now about how far will we go with genetic testing, with prenatal screening, and what is the difference between screening out certain kinds of embryos because of their possible disabilities and the often common practice in many histories and cultures of infanticide of disabled infants. Where do we draw the line?
And what excites you most about this field, literature and disability?
Well, it excites me because it's new and yet it's everywhere. So you can find disability in almost every work of literature, and yet it still often occupies this kind of invisible, paradoxically present but visible state. And so it's very exciting to introduce new people to that idea and see their eyes light up and see them say, this is a new way to look at literature that I never thought of before. And it's exciting to draw the connections between society and the social conditions of people with disabilities and literary representations. It makes the literature feel very relevant, both for me and for my students.
And as technology and literature continue to develop, it's going to be interesting to see how these three categories of disabilities are represented, the victims, the overachievers, and, of course, we'll always have to have the villains.
Absolutely.
Ellen Samuels, has been a pleasure having you with us for this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, Jonathan Kasparek will tell us about what might be called Wisconsin's first family. That would be the La Follettes from Fighting Bob onward. Join us for a visit with the La Follettes next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.